Welcome to Adult Siblings Versus, a podcast where a grown-ass brother and sister put aside their childhood rivalry in order to review nostalgic pieces of pop culture. I'm your co-host, Jason S. Leverett.
And I'm your other co-host, Arielle Leverett.
You know, what would have been cool if I had bothered to look up Renaissance artists and then refer to myself by one of them to be on brand, but I forgot to do that.
That was 100% not going to happen. The best I could have done today to be on brand was to be currently eating pizza, which I'm not, and I'm sad about it.
I ate the pizza when I watched the movie, and that was all I could promise.
I didn't. I had arepas, so not really. They were good, though.
Anyway, today we are looking at this is an interesting one. It's the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles live-action movie from 1990. So we're not talking about the more recent movies. We're not talking about the cartoon, any of the cartoons. And we're not even talking about the franchise as a whole. We are explicitly talking about the 1990 movie, and only the 1990 movie, which ended up being more controversial than I thought it was going to be.
Hmm.
But we'll talk about it. Obviously, TMNT is something that I was heavily into when I was a kid. I am in my late 30s right now, so you can just kind of guess that from the very earliest of my media consumption, Ninja Turtles was pretty much everywhere. So yeah, watched the cartoon a lot. I had a bunch of action figures.
Mm.
But I will say that I haven't really kept the sheer amount of fandom interest with that franchise the way that I do with say Transformers, which I don't have a bunch of Ninja Turtle action figures on top of a bookshelf in my condo right now. But I do have a bunch of Transformer ones. But it is still something that I do kind of keep up with to a certain degree. So coming back to watch this movie is pretty interesting for me. So I've been, it was available, so we're watching it. So, and then Ariel, being my baby sister, was forced to watch it all the time when we were children as well.
I'm easy going. It's fine.
But we're going to chat about the movie and probably a little bit about the franchise, but I don't really want this to be a focus. I think I want to have an episode dedicated to talking about the media of TMNT, the way that we did with Transformers a while back. So that'll be its own episode. Did we ever do that with X-Men? I think we were supposed to. I don't think we ever, I can't remember if we ever did.
I don't think so, because we just had the 90s series first season and Pride, but we didn't get into because we didn't get into the comics really.
Okay, I'm making a lot of promises with, and who knows if I'm ever going to keep them. So but for now, let's dig into this film. But before that, as always, I just want to kind of quickly remind you all, if you would like to reach out to us, you can find us at adultsiblingsversus@gmail.com if you want to send us an email. We did get an email for the first time recently, but we'll talk about that closer to the end. You can also tweet at us at adultversus on Twitter, and you can reach us through our Facebook page as well. If you are listening to us, thanks a lot. How else would you hear us right now? Unless you have psychic powers or you're my wife listening to the other room. but if you're listening to us on your podcatcher of choice, don't forget to like or favorite or rate us a 5-star rating, whatever your podcaster allows you to do. That's super helpful. We do not tell people to do that enough. That is the call to action. That is the second best way to help the podcast grow. The best way to help the podcast grow is to tell your friends. If you like what you're listening to, let them know about us. Maybe find an episode that you were particularly fond of and just slide it under their bed. I mean, I'm not sure how you slide a podcast under their bed, but maybe you slide your phone under their bed and then just have it play. Maybe steal their phone and change their ringtone to our podcast and then just call them constantly. I think that's the best way to do it.
Be a good friend. Come on.
Yeah. All right, Ariel. Talk to me about your thoughts on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles from a nostalgia perspective. Like, you were a little sister in this point. In fact, when I first started watching Ninja Turtles, you were legitimately a newborn. So I'm curious, like, what are your thoughts on the franchise and maybe even this movie before we revisited it today?
I feel like it's one of those things that just was always there. Like, I just feel like we watched it a lot. I think I had, like, larger opinions about the second two movies, because I think just because I was older when they came out. And I think I was, like, oddly fine with the third movie, where they're, like in, like, feudal Japan. But, like, I think the thing I remember most about it is just kind of, like, you know, I like ritual for things, and, like, having our mom make our questionable refrigerator pizza.
Freezer pizza. No, wait, it was refrigerator pizza.
Yeah,
no.
that's why it's so weird, is it's refrigerator pizza, not freezer pizza. But, like, cooking that up and watching the movie and, like, you know, kind of make it like a thing. And, yeah, because I didn't, like, really necessarily remember, like, many details about this first movie, but just, I don't know, I just, like, remember watching it.
Yeah, I think it is fair to say that we might have watched Secret of the Ooze, the sequel, a little bit more than the first one. But generally speaking, as we are a family that enjoyed, you know, we called them marathons before people started using the word binge.
Yes. We were super into it. I feel like we were really ahead of the game with that kind of shit, because I feel like we did that a lot.
Yeah. I don't remember too many times where we watched one of these movies without watching at least one other one.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I will say this. I have watched this movie relatively recently. I actually own this movie on DVD. So, I'm going to just specifically refer to my experience watching this some years ago. I think this might have been, like, 2014. Mm. So, like, Netflix had Ninja Turtles on, and I was like, oh, I haven't watched this movie in decades. Let's check it out. And I remember being very pleasantly surprised by the content of this film. I thought it was going to be much worse than it was. So I was like, okay, I want to watch more. But they didn't have any other movie on the streaming service. So I just happened to go to Target with a buddy of mine that day. And I immediately came across a 4-disc collection of the original live-action film. So 1, 2, and 3, and then also the animated TMNT movie that is apparently loosely a sequel to those. So I bought it because it was not very expensive, and it was 4 movies. And I was like, oh, I'm going to watch all of this right now. And I put in number 2, and I got through number 2, and I was like, this was garbage. This is a really bad movie. And this is even the one that has a reputation for being bad.
All I can think of with the second movie, because Shredder's hand pops out of, like, garbage, right? And it's like, ah! Doesn't that happen in the second movie? Or am I conflating that with some other movie?
I think that was, at the beginning of some early in the film, it does that, which does not gel at all with what happens to him at the end of this movie.
Because I feel like he gets trash compacted, not just, like, thrown into some garbage.
Yeah, no, his helmet is literally crushed.
Yeah.
We're getting ahead of ourselves.
Okay.
But the point is, I have not watched any of the other movies on that DVD set, even though it's sitting in my living room, because I was so disappointed about Ninja Turtles 2 that I just couldn't bring myself to watch it anymore. And I think I bought that in 2014, so take that into consideration how long it's been. All right, let's go ahead and chat a bit about how this movie came to be. So, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is a 1990 film that is based on the comic book and, let's face it, the multimedia giant of the same name. The original comic was created by Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird. This film was directed by Steve Barron with screenplay by Todd W. Langan and Bobby Herbig. The movie had a budget, eventually it had a budget of $13.5 million with a gross of $202 million. That is a crazy good return. And due to circumstances, this film was the highest grossing independent film of all time when it first came out.
Wow.
Why was this an independent film? It seems kind of weird it wouldn't be, but we'll get to that in a second. Like I said, I don't want to go too hard into the media of Ninja Turtles. I want to go into the whole thing, but I will touch a little bit briefly on the origins just so we have it out there. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was an independent comic from Mirage Studio, which was just the name that Eastman and Laird gave themselves when they were publishing the comic. The idea was they were just kind of doodling, and one of them drew a picture of a turtle dressed like a ninja, and they thought it was hilarious, so they kind of refined the drawing, and they decided, wouldn't it be funny if we made a comic book about this? The comic was not just supposed to be silly, it was also supposed to be heavily making fun of Frank Miller's run on Daredevil from the 80s. In the fact that their origin of the turtles is literally the origin of Daredevil. If Daredevil is carrying a bunch of baby turtles in a glass container. In case you guys don't know the origin of Daredevil, young Matt Murdock is walking along. An old man almost gets hit by a truck and he heroically saves him, but the truck was carrying toxic waste that splashed in his face that causes him to go blind, but gives him a radar sense and vastly increases all his other senses. So he is then becomes a superhero like years later. The Ninja Turtles origin is, what if he was carrying baby turtles? He drops the baby turtles down a grate while he's, you know, being blinded, and that toxic waste follows them down and then mutates them into talking humanoid turtles. Other things, Daredevil was trained by a ninja master named Stick, while the turtles were trained by a ninja master named Splinter. One of Daredevil's major enemies in the 80s was a ninja organization known as The Hand. The Turtles fight a ninja organization known as The Foot. But Ninja Turtles became so much more popular than Daredevil that I don't know how many people would have known this. And it's so deep in their DNA at this point, I don't think anyone would really even appreciate that at this point. So it's... funny stuff, not super important. Let's move on. The comic was a super big hit. Surprisingly so, they ended up making a deal with Playmates, a toy company, to make a toy line based on the comic, but they decided to make an animated series to support that new toy line. That cartoon came out in 87. It was a gigantic hit. The toy lines made billions of dollars. The cartoon was pretty different from the original comic. Like, it was lighter. The turtles were given colored bandanas so you could tell them apart. In the original comic book, they all wore the same color bandana. They took out the... we're not going to get too much into this today, but the original story was that Splinter raises a bunch of turtles for 15 years to murder his enemy. And the cartoon, they kind of just like... they don't go too hard on that. The most important thing is that by the late 80s, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is the biggest thing in kids' media. Is like destroying the established media presence for other children's properties before this, like Transformers, Masters of the Universe, all that sort of stuff. Is like the formula they had is just tossed in the garbage, because the Ninja Turtle formula is what is now in vogue. Based on this, you would think that the idea of making a live action movie, because there are a lot of live action movies based off of properties in the 80s, you think that might be something people were thinking about, but apparently it was. The idea of superheroes in the 80s was ruined by a series of bombs across the decade. Basically, the Superman movies, after the first one, they started being less and less good until they just became super trash by the time you get to number 4. Mm. Howard the Duck, also a major flop. And then probably the biggest thing to affect this property is the Masters of the Universe movie. Now, that is definitely a movie that we're going to have to get to at some point, because that's one that we watch a ton. But the fact is, it was absolutely critically lambasted and made about $1.50 at the box office. So people were a little hesitant to back a Ninja Turtle film. There were still people who had who thought it could work. And one of those people was Bobby Herbeck. Like, he was a writer. He went to a independent production company called Golden Harvest, who were owned by Chinese backers, weren't really 100% in the Hollywood system. They were mostly known for doing martial art films that have starred like Bruce Lee, I think, and then like Jackie Chan and Chuck Norris for some reason. They had a reputation of doing these martial arts films on the cheap. They also did Cannonball Run for on top of everything else.
All right.
But he pitched them the idea, and eventually they decided to work with him. He wrote a script that Eastman and Laird were comfortable with, and they went to work. They ended up bringing in an interesting choice of director to do this film, Steve Barron, who was mostly known for directing music videos, but directing some of the best music videos that you would have ever heard of. So that would include, let me check my list here, A-ha's Take on Me.
Ooh.
Money for Nothing from Dire Straits. Billie Jean from Michael Jackson.
Ooh.
There's a huge list. I'm looking at ones that I think are particularly interesting. Oh, yeah. Toto's Africa.
Oh. There's a lot of stuff on my running playlist.
But it's just a huge list. He's done a lot of music videos, and he's done a lot of music videos that are a bit more visually interesting than your average, let's just show musicians singing and record it type of thing.
I feel like I could see that. I feel like there is a bit of a vibe throughout this movie that does kind of feel like the part of the video before the music starts going, and you have like a scenario that the musician is in, and you know, like hanging out in like the hooligans' den and something. And next thing you know, there's a dance number. So I can see that.
Okay, yeah. All right. So, so he was brought in, but his thing was that he didn't just want to make like a kid's film. Like, he understood this was going to be for kids, but he wanted to make something that was going to be, you know, true to the spirit of the comic. Not as violent, but much more mature than the product had currently been on. And to the point that he actually went to Eastman and Laird on his own to pitch the idea. And his pitch basically was, he took an issue of their own comic and said, this is basically what I want to do. You've already done it. I just want to basically film this. And they loved that idea. But that pitch was completely at odds with the script that was already done. So, Herbeck was replaced. He was replaced by Todd W. Langan, who came up with a script much closer to what we have here. And that's kind of what the film ended up being. The film is like 80% based off of the comic books and like 20% based off of the cartoon. Now, Barron realized that if he wanted to make the film that he had in his head, he needed to come up with a way to have like the turtles be able to emote. Thankfully, on top of being a music video director, he was also a television director, and a show that he had directed several episodes of was Jim Henson's The Storyteller.
Okay.
Now, if you're not familiar with Jim Henson's The Storyteller, short version is, it was a short-lived show that Jim Henson and his workshop put together that was really showcasing the incredible advancements in practical effects and puppetry that they have really done far beyond what was going on with the Muppets. It's basically, they did movies like The Dark Crystal and the Labyrinth, and then they kept the team together to continue doing The Creature Shop. And The Storyteller was basically their big tentpole, let's put this on NBC and everyone will love it. That probably deserves its own episode at some point, because it was one half of the Jim Henson Hour, which we actually did watch a lot of, but this is neither here nor there. The short version is, Storyteller was a critical success, but a ratings failure. But the important thing is that Baron had a relationship with Jim Henson. So he went to Jim and pitched the idea of the Creature Shop making the technology for the turtles and the suits. Henson was hesitant because he was worried that doing something like this might ultimately hurt the reputation of the studio, especially since the Ninja Turtles were known for being pretty violent. But he was convinced to hop on board. The big problem, though, was that the budget for this film, because like I said, Golden Harvest likes to do things on the cheap, was $3 million total. $3 million is what Jim Henson would need to make good turtle suits. So they had to raise the budget. And then after some finagling, they ended up raising it to about $13 million. Now, production went ahead, but it ended up ending prematurely as they end up running out of money, even with the $13 million that they had. Sally Menke, who was the editor, was able to come out with a cut that Baron liked, but he felt that things hadn't really been completed enough. Like it wasn't the full story that he wanted. So Simon Fields, the producer of the film, and then Jim Henson got together and approached a party in a secret meeting to talk about potentially getting an additional $1 million for a final week of shooting. That party was none other than our old friend Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was at Disney at the time. Now, the reason this meeting was secret was because at this point, Golden Harvest had entered a distribution deal with New Line Cinema, who at the time were mostly known for B-movie schlock than anything else. So going to Disney at this point would be not something they would be happy with, but they ended up taking that meeting. They pitched the idea. Katzenberg eventually was like, yeah, this sounds good, but instead of actually giving them any money, he went directly to Golden Harvest and said, hey, so I like what I've seen. I'd be happy to get Disney to distribute this film if we can make a deal. To which Golden Harvest replied, oh, cool, thanks, but we're going to stick with New Line Cinema. Goodbye. And then immediately fired Baron and Fields. And then Menke quit in solidarity with the other one. So at this point, the director and the producer have been fired from the film. They make a final cut of the film without any of their input and go ahead and release it. So there was some controversy with this film. I assume that because there's a lot of pushback between Baron and Golden Harvest about like how much for kids this film should be. But I imagine that with him gone, the final cut may have ended up being a little bit more on the silly side than it may have originally was going to be. But the most important thing is that we will never escape Jeffrey Katzenberg.
Yeah, he is Jesus.
Just tied to our lives. If we go too many episodes without mentioning him, history will rearrange itself. It turns out that he's like a secret producer on like some random thing. Like we're gonna watch Generation X. It's gonna turn out that he paid everything out of pocket in order to spite Disney or something like that.
Please, if you like suddenly see Jeffrey Katzenberg rise in the mirror behind me, please let me know. Don't let him get me.
Well, you've said his name a dangerous amount of times.
Jesus Christ.
So we should probably move on. So I've talked for about a million years here, so I think we're good to go. But I will mention one last thing. In this particular episode, I ended up getting a lot of my information from one major source, and that is a YouTube channel by the name of Toy Galaxy. They did an episode on this movie a few weeks back. So I would definitely encourage you to check their YouTube channel out. It's it's a pretty interesting thing. They talk about toys. They talk about old cartoons. They kind of do like mini retrospective documentary type things on a bunch of different properties. And the host is a charming and handsome fellow. So I think he could give it a shot. All right. Anyway, I'm going to stop myself from talking now. So Ariel, when I was watching the movie last night, I ended up having deep dish pizza and I got pizza drunk real fast. So I only vaguely remember the details of what happened. So would you mind going through the plot a little bit? Tell us what's going on.
Awesome. So the story takes place. We're in New York And there's a crime wave happening. A lot of thieves running around the city, stealing stuff right from under people's noses. It turns out you can't even watch your TV on your fire escape. You look away for a second and that shit is gone. There is only one reporter who seems properly interested in getting to the bottom of who's doing this, and that is April O'Neil. And she tries to, like, investigate this, and she puts pressure on the police department, like, what is happening? I've heard things from local Japanese Americans comparing this crime wave to happenings in Japan with a group of, like, ninja thieves. And it's like, this seems pretty similar. Are you paying attention to this? He's not. Meanwhile, this organization, which is the Foot, sees that April is doing this and they start going after her. But luckily, she is defended by a group of mystery ninjas who turn out to be giant turtles, and they protect her. And she basically becomes friends with them and goes to their realm and in the sewers. And you meet the Ninja Turtles. So you have Leonardo, Donatello, Michelangelo, and Raphael, and their fearless leader, Splinter. And you learn about their backstory and their relationship to the Shredder, who turns out to be the leader of said organization, the Foot, and his history with Splinter in the cutest fucking sequence. Little rat puppet doing like
15 years ago.
So we'll get into this later, but it really does seem like he constantly wants to tell that story. Like, I feel like no matter who he's talking to, he will get to that story. Yeah, and they also receive help from Casey Jones, who's, you know, he don't know karate, but he knows sports, and that's good enough. And yeah, they have to defeat the Foot in the best way they know how. Their fists. And also weapons. So yeah, fun time. Woo!
Okay. So I'm of two minds here about this film. One is that as someone who grew up watching this film, I feel this movie has held up shockingly well. Like, you would think that an older superhero movie from decades past would, especially with the reputation of this franchise, it has had some really bad movies over the time. The original one would probably also be kind of bad. It actually held up pretty well. Like, if they made this movie with the exact same tone, and maybe just updated some of, like, the atmosphere and technology and released that today, I think it would look pretty good. It would not be out of place with some of the Marvel movies. But then, like, the other train of thought is that I think that for someone who doesn't have that the nostalgia goggles on, I still think that it's a pretty decent film to watch with your kids. Like, I think that's this is a pretty good family film where you are not going to be super bored as a parent. So that's, like, the major point I want to make about this film before we get to anything else.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you for the most part. There are definitely, like, this movie doesn't have, like, the worst version of this, but, like, you know, it's not a great movie for women, and honestly, not a great movie for Asian people. Like, the white men dubbing with, like, I don't know what the Asian version of Black Scent is, but whatever that is, that happens in this, and it's not great.
Yeah.
But, like, the vibe of the movie, yeah, like, I do think it could be done today.
Yeah, well, okay, let's put it like this. I think this movie's held up better than Tim Burton's Batman, which is also not good for women.
Mm. It's been a I don't know when's the last time I've seen that movie. I'm not 100% sure I've seen that movie in adulthood, now that I think about it. We'll have to do that at some point.
Let me put it this way. They have the same amount of female characters, but April O'Neil is significantly tougher and more interesting than Vicki Vale.
Sure.
So I do enjoy this film. I understand there's problems. We're going to get into that. But I do like that the film takes so much of the comic as opposed to the cartoon. The cartoon is ridiculous, but they took the elements of the cartoon to make the characters more recognizable, like their love of pizza, which did not appear in the comic, and fleshing out some of the characteristics that aren't necessarily in the comic. Like Michelangelo, I think his character in the comic originally was that he was the youngest. That was his character. Where in the comic book, the cartoon, his character was the surfer guy slash the dumb one, which is not necessarily, you know, Shakespeare writing characters here, but it still feels a little bit more involved. But yeah, I liked that the Shredder is depicted as really frightening and terrifying a villain, and that the characters don't even see him for the first time until the very end of the film. Like, they're like, who's this guy? And with no idea that he's the guy who's been pulling the strings. I do like that the restraint that they had on that. I thought that April O'Neil's character had a pretty good rapport with the Turtles. They're not in a ton of scenes together, honestly, as she works for a living. I really like the scene. I mean, I don't like what Michelangelo is doing because it's stupid, but I like the scene of the Turtles hanging out at her apartment and just like chilling out and eating pizza, and they're all getting along. It's like a little quiet moment of that. I really enjoy that sort of thing.
I always enjoy that sort of thing too. The little plot breaks that movies tend to do, where you get to see them just kind of exist.
And boy howdy, do I love the lair of the foot.
I know, right?
Like, my wife was watching this and she was like, you know what? If this place was shown to a kid at any time, they would probably definitely join a ninja cult.
Yeah. It's like, give me a bottle of Coke and let me play those video games for a while, and sure, I'll steal some stuff for you. This is great.
Have you been to the Emporium barcade location in Logan Square?
I have. I think maybe only once or twice with you. Like, maybe just once. I remember going with you once. But it does have a similar feeling to that.
Yeah, like, it feels like somebody wanted to make the Foot Clan lair for the kids who watch this movie, who are now old enough to buy alcohol. I think the absolute best thing about this film, though, is the technology for the turtle suits, the puppetry for that. This was considered the most technologically advanced thing that the Creature Shop had ever done. Like, they had just taken their whole skill set to the next level doing this, which is a thing that they were kind of known for. But I really like it. I mean, it doesn't hold up super great, like, today, right? But looking back on, like, when the year would have come out, like, these characters actually do look like they're emoting. They actually definitely look like they have personality to them. And all this stuff is done by remote, and, like, there's, like, people, like, in some back room with puppet hands moving those mouths in perfect sync with the dialogue, which is being recorded at the time, but then they record it over later, but that's, we'll get to that in characters, probably. It's just really impressive looking. It doesn't look so bad that it took me out, but it really made me upset, like, more upset about, like, how CG characters have really taken over things, because if the Creature Shop had been working on this technology from 1990 to 2017 or whenever that first reboot Ninja Turtles movie came out, can you imagine what the technology would have looked like by then?
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I love practical effects. And I would say for this movie, I'm pretty sure I only saw a zipper once. That's saying something. This is still like a relatively low budget thing, and a lot is happening. But like,
yeah.
As far as, you know, the ability to work all of these animatronics and to make these masks emote is, like, I guess I'm thinking about this kind of thing a lot because right now I'm in rehearsal for a play where I'm puppeteering a robot puppet and, like, currently going through how to make this thing emote and stuff like that. And so, like, I feel for their efforts. It's not easy to do.
This movie is far from a perfect film. And let's just kind of go ahead and start with, like, the point that you mentioned. We'll start with the fact that it's not really the greatest movie for ladies. I think there is literally only one female actor, let alone character, in this whole this whole shebang. Is that correct?
I think there might have been like one other woman at the like news station. I think, if I'm remembering.
Oh yeah, because she was there was a there was someone that was interviewing April.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of it. Like New York.
Oh hey, actually that. Oh shoot, this movie passes the Bechdel test because they were talking about the ninjas. A ninja crime wave, not a specific dude.
I mean, the Bechdel test is.
Well, I think what you're saying is like, you know, the Bechdel test is not necessarily an doesn't necessarily prove if something is or is not feminist.
Yes.
Which is definitely true because a lot of pornography also passes the Bechdel test.
That's a t-shirt. Yeah. So. It's just like it's hard because like on like this isn't like the worst version of this kind of thing because like April she does have a personality and she is strong willed, she does have something to her, but she also is such a plot point for like all the men around her, and like the way everyone treats her, whether they like her or not, like it's just like God, what a bummer living in this world. Things as simple as like, why does her boss keep on just like coming to her house and just strolling around? He follows her into the fucking bathroom. Like, what's going on here? And like,
I was okay with the first time he came by her apartment, but the second time when the turtles were actually there and hiding, I was just thinking like, what the hell are you even doing? And like, yeah, following her in the bathroom. That's weird.
Yeah, it's weird. Super weird. I gotta say, I have a lot of jobs and I have a lot of bosses. Ain't nobody just like come into my house. And that includes like people who I know well. Like, it's weird. It's weird. And just like, yeah, the nature of it was like, you know, even like the first thing that the Ninja Turtles say when they see her on TV is like, ah, she's such a babe and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's just.
Oh my God.
Everything is very shallow with the way people
let me touch on her. That for a quick second because I have to basically make amends for a thing that I did for years in that one of the reasons I didn't go see the more recent live action Ninja Turtle movies was because of how raunchy they were making the turtles seem like they were getting about Megan Fox as the new April O'Neil. I think like the line was like, oh, my shell's getting tighter. Ooh. Which is vulgar and gross. But they're less vulgar and less gross, but still doing the same thing in this film. And I was, I had not remembered that. And I was never being like, oh, that's a bummer. That's a bummer. Oh, man, I think I might owe Michael Bay an apology. And that was upsetting.
And it's always, like, frustrating with, like, movies of this era. Like, her and Casey Jones, when you have, like, this guy being, like, outrageously sexist and like she fights with him and there is honestly no real reason for her to really start feeling like to be like, I guess I like you now and I'm attracted to you. Like they always make that happen. It's just like, he's a dick. Like I wish they didn't always have to be like, well, he's managed to stop calling her abroad, so like it's good enough for her and now they can be a pair. And it's just like that's a dated thing. But it's just, it's still annoying, you know?
Yeah. I have a lot to say about Casey Jones, but I'll save it for characters.
I'm sad this is not a story about a train engineer. I keep waiting for that, and it keeps not happening.
Okay. Okay.
Pulling locomotives, you know?
Okay. But, let's go to the other thing you mentioned, which is also a problem, in that they hire Japanese actors to star in this film, including James Saito, who is, he's famous. Yeah. He's in a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But then they dub over everybody with white actors doing like, you know, Asian-y accents. And you know what? Okay, maybe, I think Toshihiro Obata, who plays Tatsu, I think he legitimately doesn't speak English.
Sure. Yeah, that is the impression that I got.
I don't know how good James Saito's English was in 1989 when they filmed this. Or 88. It was this film was filmed around the same time as the Batman was filmed. So, not the Batman, but regular Batman, adjectiveless Batman. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what Saito's English was at the time. maybe there was something similar, but I have seen him in so many things where he has like perfectly fine English, if not perfect English. Like, I just saw him in Always Be My Maybe, and he was perfectly fine. Yeah. I have no idea what the what the situation was, but I it's just a little weird because he's around. He's been around so long, doing so many things. It's a little hard for me to wrap my head around the idea that his English would have been so bad that they had to dub somebody else in. I don't know, but here what I do know is that it is not a good look to do things this way.
Nope.
And you can say this is just of the time, and we might even be lucky that they even bothered hiring Japanese actors to play the physical roles, as that was not a given at all. That year and the years before. But it's, looking at it with modern lenses, it is hard and not super great. And it's like when you watch Bill and Ted and then they drop the F-bomb. It's like, I know why. I know that it wasn't like derogatory slurs against gay people was not as cared about avoiding in those days as it would be modern times, but every time I see them do it, I get completely taken out of the film.
Yeah, that is very, very true. Like, when they do it, you're just like, ooh, oh, this don't feel good. This don't feel good in my tummy.
No, not at all. Other problems I have with this film that are less, like, socially problematic, and less aged badly problematic, is things this movie isn't very, it's not a very expensive movie. Like, it's $13 million, that's nothing to sneeze at, but a lot of that is going to making the technology for the turtles. But and as a result, the movie feels very empty. Like, it doesn't feel like this is a lived-in world.
Mm.
Like the only time you ever see crowds in this film are, like, B-roll footage of New York. And this movie was mostly filmed in North Carolina on a soundstage. So, like, a great example of where it's just very jarring is in the final fight where the turtles are fighting the Foot Clan all in the streets, and they're slowly making their way up to the rooftops before they fight the Shredder. They're making a lot of noise. And I know it's the middle of the night, but no one seems to notice or care. Like, you don't see any civilians poking their heads out. Nobody calls the cops. The cops get there way later. after the action is pretty much over. And it is crazy to me. There's no just how few people you see.
They have technically established that the people of New York do not give a fuck with that moment early in the movie when Raphael rolls over the hood of the taxi car, the taxi cab, and the passenger of the cab is like, "What was that?" And the driver is like, "Yeah, it looked like a turtle." In a trench coat. It's a giant turtle in a trench coat. You go into LaGuardia and to make you go, "Oh, New York." So maybe they've established that no one cares about anything.
Two things I'll point out about that. There is still a guy in that cab who is rightfully freaked out.
He was a tourist.
He's a tourist. Yeah. Oh, yes. Maybe he was a tourist. Yeah, he had a New York accent,
though. I decided that the passenger was a tourist.
Yeah. The other thing is that the fun thing about that scene is that Raphael is hopping over that car, but Raphael is also the guy being freaked out because it's the suit actor in his only live action scene.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's fun. That's cute.
Yeah. And that's why I said he had a New York accent, because he sounds exactly like Raphael, who inexplicably has a very thick New York accent.
Yeah.
Compared to his brothers. But yeah, it just doesn't feel like there's a lot of human beings in there, and it's gotta be because of the budget. There's just not old enough there. Also, I don't so when this film ran out of money, they had filmed the ending, but they apparently had 12 pages of script that they hadn't shot. And knowing that going into this, I think I was able to pick up a little bit on where that might have been, because there's a couple of things that happen in this film that just kind of, there's not a lot of build up to it, that it just sort of happens. There seems like we're missing some context for some things. Like, for example, why was Casey Jones in the antique store at all? Like, he had one encounter with Raphael, probably nowhere near that location. So why did he happen to be all the way across town at all? I bet there was a scene in those 12 pages that would have made that make a little bit more sense.
Sure.
They don't really talk about exactly why they're going to the farm.
Yeah.
Like, I guess to hide out, but they don't have a conversation about it. They don't go like, there's not like a scene in the car going like, where should we go? And April's like, well, you know, I grew up on a farm in upstate New York. Maybe we should hang out there for a while before we make our next plan. No, they just show up at a farm and you hear like some dubbed going, yeah, like, I haven't been here in years.
Yeah, like all of a sudden we have like April's like Dear Diary sequence. Like she's like legit like now like writing her memoirs and drawing these oddly good sketches. Like I feel like she kind of missed her calling and maybe she should forget about reporting and like be an illustrator.
Do we know that she doesn't just do that on the side? It might be a side hustle.
Maybe. But like when Danny, the troubled good boy, when he like leaves him talking to Splinter and like Shredder catches him, is like, I know you've been up to something, and he takes the sketch that April has drawn of Leonardo, like he's like, it's a lovely drawing of him and sleeping in the chair, and part of me wanted Shredder to like angrily look at it and just go, this is beautiful. Did you draw this? Like, I just like, I wanted some acknowledgement of the quality of the drawing, but whatever.
Looks at it like, they're back. Looks back at her. This is actually quite good. Do you think you could get a picture of me and Tasu?
If only. They're like posing through that classic one sitting down and the other one has their hand on the other one's shoulder. Just like, all right, go now. Like, it would have been great.
That's just making me think of Step Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
And that is making me think that like the origin of Shredder and Tatsu working together ended with them like, did we just become best friends? Hi. Oh, God. Okay, so, yeah, I think there's just a couple of, like, scenes that happen, like, throughout the film where if those 12 pages had gotten shot, it might have just been a fuller movie. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, they ran out of money, they weren't able to do it, and you just kind of tell. It doesn't, like, break the immersion too much. Like, it's fine, especially if you're younger.
Yeah.
I just couldn't help. I might not have noticed it as much if I hadn't known that there are missing 12 pages before going in. All things considered, this is edited quite well to kind of work around that. Mm. Let's see. We already talked about how cute pre-mutation Splinter is.
Although it's very funny when Splinter talks about his past.
15 years ago.
Like, which I just guarantee every you don't get out of a conversation with him without him telling that fucking story. It's like, I was a pet of my master. Is it, I can't remember, is it Master Yoshi or Roshi?
Miss Master Yoshi. Master Roshi's from Dragon Ball.
Oh, God. That's why it's in my head. I was a pet of my Master Yoshi. And the way the sequence, especially like when he goes into it a second time, so you get the visual to the full thing, and the fight, and little rat Splinter, basically little rat sobbing over his master. It's like, this is pre-toxic waste, because he was talking about how like he grew in intelligence with that waste. It's just like, this is a lot coming from a rat who just seems to be a rat. Like, that's a little confusing. Yeah, I just think the way he described it, I think it probably should have been like a little bit clearer, because like he goes out of his way to say he grew in size and intelligence. Just like, I don't know.
Particularly in intellect. Yeah. Like he definitely says that. I don't know. Like, maybe he was a super smart rat, but a super smart rat still can't talk.
I would be more interested in having a pet rat if I knew that it would practice karate in its cage.
Anything else about the movie proper before we move into characters, which is probably where a lot of the meat's going to come in?
This movie did, you know, there's a Domino's down the street from me, and it really was all I could do to not get some Domino's.
The funny thing is that they've changed their formula in the decade since then, so it wouldn't even be the same type of Domino's. Here's a funny trivia. So Domino's is all over the place in this film, but it was Pizza Hut that had the licensing deal with the Turtles in the years that followed. So even though you see a lot of Domino's here, Domino's didn't have that tie-in deal in the real world later. It was a completely different pizza company.
It's so weird. Why do you think there suddenly is like a telepathy thing? Is that like something, like, you know, like with Leonardo, where they're like, they're on the farm and Leonardo has like this like psychic connection moment with Splinter. And then they kind of do this like, you know, Splinter seance thing at the fire. What the hell is that?
So there's no good answer to this question. And I didn't write this script, so obviously I can't answer that. However, I assume it is part of this concept of like spiritual power associated with martial arts and the mysterious Far East, where you become so like good at martial arts that you have magic powers, which is a concept that has been all over media, specifically media made by white people in America about Japan and China. So I just have to assume it's more of that. It's more magic from the mysterious East. I don't know. There's no good answer. I guess the actual answer is because the plot says so.
Sure.
Oh, you know what? I did think of one other issue I had with the film that I guess could be with characters. But just to kind of point it out, none of the characters have arcs. It seems like Raphael should have an arc, but he doesn't have one. Maybe it was in those 12 pages that didn't get filmed.
I mean, Danny decides to stop stealing things and gives.
Okay, cool. That's a great point. Danny, the 14-year-old psychic character who we never see again after this film, does indeed have an arc.
I love at the end when he gives April back the 20 or whatever that he stole from her in the beginning, and he gives back to her. She doesn't know why that he's giving this to her, and he's just like I owe this to you. Trust me, and it's just, or whatever. It's like trust me, this is yours or whatever. And it's so funny that he's like essentially like, trust me, I stole from you earlier. Like, it's just so fucking dumb.
Yeah. Actually, that whole last sequence with him is kind of underwhelming. Like, his interaction with his dad just kind of seems like it's falls flat. And it's like, thank God, are you okay? He's like, yeah, I'm okay. Also, call me Dan now.
Oh, Dan. Okay, give me a hug, son. Yeah, it's so...
Like, it's like, okay, you've been missing for days, and when you show up, it is with this gang bust.
Yeah. And he just gets to walk away. He doesn't get in trouble at all.
I don't know. It is silly. Anyway, let's talk about characters. So, important to note that the four main characters don't really have fully realized characters, hence the reason they don't have character arcs. Raphael's probably the best one. But let's just go through this. That's a little complicated. I'll try to go through this. So, the suit actors for the Turtles are David Foreman as Leonardo, Leif Tilden as Donatello, Josh Paris as Raphael, and then Michael Sisti as Michelangelo. Now, funny story, on the set, all four of these actors were reading the lines and they were being recorded. Only Josh Paris, Josh Paris, only he had his, got to remain the voice of Raphael. He's the only turtle who is both the suit actor and the voice. The voice actors for everyone else was Brian Tochi as Leonardo, Corey Feldman, who got the prestige credit, by the way.
Yeah, I keep thinking about that. I was like, I bet they were like super fucking excited that they could put him on the bill.
Yeah, they got him as Donatello. I do not know how that came about. Because everyone else in the cast is very, like, they were hired with budget in mind. Corey Feldman was one of the biggest names in the young actor world in Hollywood in the 80s, so I'm not sure how that came about. Maybe he's a big fan of Ninja Turtles and just want to be a part of it no matter
or
what.
Or he just needed...
Don't know.
I mean, at this point, because it's like, I mean, now we're getting into the late 80s. Maybe he just needed cocaine money.
He might need a cocaine money, but I mean, like, he turned down cocaine money for the sequel for some reason, so I don't know what's going on. Anyway, he played Donatello. I didn't actually say that, but he played Donatello. And then Robbie Rist as Michelangelo, who, by the way, doesn't reprise his role, but he plays a character named Mondo Gecko in the 2012 Ninja Turtles cartoon, who the joke about that character is that he acts exactly the way that Michelangelo acted in the 80s.
Huh.
And I didn't realize it was the same guy who voiced the character in this movie until today. Like, Michelangelo in the 2012 doesn't say cowabunga, he says booyakasha, because it's 2012.
God.
But Mondo Gecko absolutely says cowabunga, and they're all like, dude, that's a weird thing to say. It's like, is it dudes? Cowabunga! It's like, he's skateboarding, and he's like, I now realize how fun that character is, now that I know that Robbie Rist was actually the actor playing him. But yeah, I don't know why the other actors in the suits didn't continue on to be the voice cast. And if I were to make a guess, I'd say that their performances weren't good enough for them to consider it. But somehow, Josh Pius's performance, they were like, wow, this guy really feels like Raphael. Let's keep him.
I could see that. I'm assuming when they were like auditioning these guys, I'm sure they had a lot of screen tests and readings and stuff. And I could see, like, maybe it's just that Joss Pius, like, won them over. And they're like, no, when I hear his voice, I actually hear Raphael.
Yeah, I think that's possible. And you know what? He is great. Like, he is, like, he really feels like a good amalgamation of the comic Raphael and the cartoon Raphael. The acting throughout, like, all down the road with these four characters, I think is really good. Like, with the suit acting and the gesturing, the body language, I think really works. And the fact that they have to like somehow give emotion despite the fact that their faces are being controlled by somebody else,
yeah,
I think is really tough. And I think they end up doing pretty good with it. I think that the voice acting is quite good. I think that they all have distinct voices. And like they definitely feel like four unique characters. My big problem with them is that they just don't really go far enough as characters. Like, Raphael does. Raphael actually gets a lot of screen time, and even though they don't really wrap up an arc, they seem like to be setting up for, like, can he learn to control his anger and be a team player? That doesn't actually get solved in this film or in the series, I think. So that's kind of a bummer, but like, he does have a definite, like, more of a three-dimensional picture of him than the rest of them. Where the other three kind of, like, Michelangelo seems to, like, to be like he's the one that likes pizza and says, dude. But like, Donatello and Leonardo, I don't really, they have distinct ways of talking and they clearly have different personalities, but exactly anything deeper than that is kind of missing. Like, yeah. Like, Donatello is supposed to be the brains of the group, and the only indication you get of that is that sometimes he says things that makes him sound intelligent, but...
Yeah, I think he definitely gets the shortest end of the stick, personality-wise, in this.
Just as many times there are lines that he says that make him seem like he's just as silly as Michelangelo. So, like, it's... The sequel, they really up that, you know, they up his intelligence being shown on screen, but... here, you know, there's like a couple instances, like they're playing like some sort of trivia game and he gets the answer immediately. I mean, that sort of thing. Like, he's kind of a nerdy guy. He sometimes can't think of cool things to say when they're like saying their cheers. Like, he says bossa nova and everyone's like, that's weird. And then Leonardo, it's hard to do Leonardo in the best of times, like, because his personality usually comes to just being he's the leader.
Yeah.
And here, he's kind of barely the leader. They really feel like they're, yeah, like four guys who are like all equals, as opposed to Leonardo calling the shot, so to speak. He even denies being the leader when Raphael sarcastically says that he is. He's not uptight. That's another character trait that sometimes Leonardo gets, that he's like the uptight one. He's not really. He's just as silly and playful as the rest of the gang.
And like, you could have made that a thing, like, it could be that his arc could be him struggling with like taking on that role, because like you can, it's kind of hard with this movie because like you kind of have the seeds for this to happen, because just like, you know, they have that little, I think it's Leonardo and Donatello, they have a little moment of like, well, it's like, he ever thought about like what Splinter said about him not being here?
And no, like, that, oh, was Donatello, that was Donatello and Michelangelo.
Oh, it's Michelangelo. See, it should have been, if it had been with Leonardo, and it could have been him being like, well, I hate the idea of that, blah, blah, or in like, if it could have been like an added character thing for him getting to the point of like, no, I'm taking the reins and I'm going to be strong for my clan and we're going to do this and save Splinter. It wasn't that far from it, and who knows, this might have been something that could have been explored in those pages that never got there. But yeah. It's disappointing when you have things, it's like you have the ingredients but you just decided not to make the cake.
Yeah. I think that that there could have been more done with them, but the acting is solid and there's a lot of things going against them to make something that solid, and they end up pulling it off, and that is a great team effort. Like, we should also shout out the puppeteers who were involved as well. Speaking of puppets, I want to talk about Splinter.
Yeah.
I did not mention Splinter while I was talking about Asian characters, Japanese characters being dubbed in, because I don't know, Splinter is a rat. I'm not 100% certain like if how much appropriation this is, but he does almost always sound Japanese, so there might still some racism there as well.
100% is still not good, because it's still like, because Kevin Clash is because he's puppeteering and voicing,
am I correct? Yes, he is.
But you have Kevin Clash, who is a black guy, who is still going out of his way to make this kind of false East Asian accent. So it's still not right. This kind of like, I don't know, I'm going to just talk in a vaguely Asian way. It's, once again, it's the kind of thing that like nowadays we'd immediately be like, no, like even if for some reason you have to dub this stuff, it should be dubbed by people who are actually that ethnicity, who actually know something about the freaking accent that they're doing. Like, yeah.
I mean, you say that, but even the most recent Ninja Turtle movies, Tony Shalhoub was the voice of Splinter in that, and was, so they still hadn't learned their lesson decades later.
It's not good. Not good, Hollywood. You're the worst. We have to pester you so much to be not the worst. Like, if you are putting it, it's like, basically, like, any actor should just make it just a point of your principles that if you are doing the accent of an ethnicity that isn't yours, you should just not do it. That's a really, you should just like, you know what? I don't know anything about this. I don't feel comfortable. It's not my heritage. I'm not going to do it. If you decide like, it's fine, I'm good at it, then that, I don't think that's a good enough reason.
The most interesting thing about Splinter, I was shocked to find out that Kevin Clash did this. Kevin Clash is most famous for being the puppeteer and voice of Elmo for decades before a whole thing happened that I don't think we've got time to go into today, other than I just found out today that his problems didn't go away because they were necessarily false allegations. They went away because the statute of limitation had ended. So,
wow,
not great. Anyway, I was shocked because Elmo and the voice of Splinter, I would never in a million billion years have guessed that it was the same actor. Now, to be fair, pretty
diametrically opposed. True.
I would not have ever guessed that the voice of the puppeteer who does Elmo is the same puppeteer that did Clifford from the Muppet from Muppets Tonight, and that's a much smaller stretch than this. But even so, like, years, I had no idea. Also, I'm unsure why they didn't hire Kevin Clash to do this more often, because Kevin Clash is probably not a hard get. Like, some of these actors, like, you're not going to get Corey Feldman to necessarily voice somebody in a in a video game. Maybe eventually you would. But Kevin Clash probably could have gotten... He's never returned to the role. He's just kind of, aside from the sequels to this, but he never returned like in any other media or like the, or even like the live action TV show or the, any of the cartoons. A little surprising. Cause I think he, if for, even though it's problematic, I do think that he does a pretty good job. I would not have guessed who it was by the voice, but it's probably just as well. Speaking of black people playing Japanese characters in the Ninja Turtles, I do want to talk about Shredder. I want to talk about the Shredder who has, in this case, not it hasn't happened, or has it? Have I? I think
no, it's not in this movie.
Okay, but at least two other major adaptations of the Ninja Turtles, Splinter, Shredder is voiced by a black guy. I'm not sure why that keeps happening, but I kind of want it to keep happening. I don't know why. I'm enamored with it.
Because it's James Avery, isn't it?
James Avery played him in the original cartoon. And then Kevin Michael Richardson, best known as that one dude from Homeboys in Outer Space.
Vashti?
Yeah.
Oh, he's my favorite. I always get so excited as soon as I hear his voice.
Yeah, but he ends up playing him in the 2012 cartoon, which is funny because there's a point where the 1980s Shredder is transported to the 2012 Turtles world, and it's still Kevin Michael Richardson playing him, but he's doing his best Avery Brooks as Shredder impression, and it's really funny. Or Avery Brooks, no, James. He's doing his best James Avery impression, and it's really funny. Avery Brooks, I believe, is Cisco.
The human embodiment of jazz.
Yeah. The human embodiment of a jazz cigarette.
That's one of my favorite sayings from you.
Anyway, we kind of talked about like the problem with the Shredder, but I do think that, I just want to reiterate, is how well I think the Shredder comes off in this film. Like, he just seems like a nightmare. Like, he just seems like this, like, extraordinarily dangerous person that you ignore the outfit. You ignore the fact that he's a grown man that calls himself a Shredder. Okay. He has this presence that just makes him feel just terrifying. And yeah, I really like that.
Super foreboding. Yeah, I agree with you. They use him a very good amount to, like, just make him menacing and kind of looming.
This keeps up in the sequel, but they kind of fell on their face on the landing by introducing a Super Shredder.
Oh yeah. Oh, I forgot about that. Oh goodness.
Judith Hoag plays April O'Neil. I think April comes off pretty good here. I don't love there's a rat, I want to jump on a chair, type of stuff from women in these things, because I think it's just a cliche and not very cool. But I will say that it sets up her reaction to Splinter, so that's probably why.
Yeah.
But I think she's pretty good here. She won't come back. The actress will not come back to the series after this, as she apparently had a problem with the level of violence in this movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, apparently that's a big thing. If we ever get into Secret of the Ooze, we're going to talk about that. Mm. Elias Koteas plays Casey Jones. This guy is a major character actor. He is always working. Like, I am most familiar with him as a main character from Chicago PD, the TV show. And if you had told me that was Casey Jones 30 years later, I would have been like, that's not true.
Is he? Oh, he's done in Chicago PD. I was like, I could act with him in theory one day, but no, he's not on the show anymore.
No, he's not on the show anymore. I hate Casey Jones in this movie.
Yeah.
Now, on the one hand, he's more of a character than Casey Jones in the cartoon, because the portrayal of Casey Jones in the cartoon is probably the worst portrayal of the character in the entire franchise, as he's a psychotic who won't take off his mask and I believe talks like he's Dirty Harry. But Casey Jones in here is, I don't know, is he going to murder those guys that Raphael stopped from mugging that lady? Like, is that what the thing was? He's like, hey, you did your job, now it's time to do mine. Kill them with a hockey stick.
I mean, I guess I was just under the impression that he was going to just beat them up more. But maybe some hockey stick murder, who knows?
I mean, he definitely kills Shredder. Like, he does it cold-heartedly, almost jokingly, murders a man who has already been incapacitated.
Yeah, I really hate that, like, he is getting the upper hand of all of these, like, trained martial artists because he has some kind of sports utensil and he whacks people. Like, it just, it's a bummer.
Now, okay, the concept of Casey Jones I'm okay with because I do, because Casey Jones, like, you know, he's a good fighter. He knows how to do stuff. And, like, you know, I can even take the idea of him beating Raphael because Raphael is, like, 15 years old and, is a hothead and probably underestimated him. But, and I could even take the idea of him taking out these ninjas because most of those ninjas are probably like 20 years old at best, who have only been doing ninjutsu for like 6 months.
I guess this thought really came up when he like beats Tatsu.
Yeah, Tatsu should have killed him.
Yeah, yes. The fact that like, oh, well, game's over because I found a golf club. And it's like, come on.
And it's clear that the golf clubs are not even his weapon of choice because he's all like, I'll never call golf a boring game again because it's like he clearly doesn't carry the golf clubs around. So if he found like a hockey stick and it was like, ah, now I'm at 100%.
Yeah, now I am whole again.
At last, my arm is whole again. Yeah, but like he's also super sexist, like you said, like he's upsettingly so. There's, and you know, all the negative stuff about him would be okay if there was more of an understanding of him as a decent person beneath that. Yeah. But there isn't.
Yeah.
Maybe that was in the 12 pages. I don't know.
That's why it's just like, it's so upsetting that she ends up like liking him because he literally has done nothing to promote that. Like, why? He's just as like, he's the same personality that he was a minute ago when you were arguing with him about being such a dick. And I was just like, it's fine.
I guess it's just the idea that all women want bad boys.
Boy. Jeez.
You know what? Those two characters never share another scene together in the rest of the trilogy. So maybe it didn't work out. Anybody else? Raymond Serra as Stearns. What I only want to mention is that I find it very interesting that he goes to such lengths to make sure people don't know he's incompetent. Like he blackmails the TV station basically so that no one will know that he's not taking these things seriously instead of just taking them seriously. You know, if he's like I think a competent police officer would be like, okay, I should at least look into these accusations of what's going on in Japan, in Little Tokyo. Because this is now dragging my name through the mud. So I can at least say that I did it, and then she's wrong. No, he's all like, he's more like, you know, I think what I actually want to do instead is nothing. And by God, I will blackmail anyone who gets in the way of me doing nothing.
By God. Yeah, it is pretty ridiculous. Just like, because we mentioned, you know, Danny and his dad, who's Charles, who is actually like April's boss, and how much I really dislike Charles. I think he's a creep. And it's like, I think Danny keeps stealing stuff because his dad's a creep. And, yeah. But we have to do our shout out to Sam Rockwell.
Head, oh my God.
Head thug.
Baby face Sam Rockwell. You said that Danny had a character arc. Sam Rockwell's character also has a character arc.
Actually, yeah.
So Sam Rockwell, who I believe this is only his second film, and his first film he still wasn't starring, because he was kind of a late bloomer as far as like Hollywood stardom. I don't think anyone really knew who he was until...
Galaxy Quest.
Galaxy Quest. And then even then, he wasn't really a big name for years after that. Yeah, but Sam Rockwell plays... He's credited as Head Thug, but he's basically the guy who is showing folks around when they first come into the Foot Clan and offers them cigarettes, and then he is like the guy who argues with Casey Jones about family.
Yeah.
And then he's the guy who tells the incompetent police where they can find the stolen goods without mentioning the stolen goods, and nobody arrests him because they're incompetent.
Ridiculous. It is crazy the amount of kids are just like, ah, you're fine.
Yeah. They literally walk away. They all walk away, and it's fine. But I had no idea Sam Rockwell was in this goddamn movie, and it is crazy. Like, he's the biggest name in this film, with maybe the exception of Feldman, but that wouldn't happen for like another 20 years. It's like watching He-Man in the Masters of the Universe movie and then realizing Courtney Cox is in it. Except that Courtney Cox was a main character. It's like finding out that Courtney Cox was like the bartender or something.
Yeah.
Oh, also, I just want to point out that I don't understand what Charles was doing to try to keep April from not reporting that, because he's being blackmailed, and he's just like, hey, I just want you to like maybe consider not doing the case, maybe getting some help. She's like, no. And he's like, okay, well, that's all I've tried. I guess he'll get the message now. And then when she doesn't, he fires her for basically nothing. Like, he doesn't warn her, you don't do this or you're fired. He's just like, maybe you want some help. No, okay. Oh crap, she's doing it. You're fired. What a jerk. Sam Rockwell should have been the boss. Sam Rockwell should have played everyone in this.
Everyone's disrespecting April, including the foot members in their costumes when they catch her at the subway. And this is another example of, like, I don't know who was voicing the one guy who decided to do like the most outrageous accent on saying O'Neill. Because he literally goes Miss O'Neill, and they have a moment where it's like, we have a message for you from the foot, and he holds out his hand and then just slaps her and goes, shut it. It's ridiculous.
I mean, like, what was their plan? Because like, they were supposed to silence her, and I thought that meant kill her. And if that was to kill her, why even talk to her? Why don't you just stab her?
It seems like silencer just meant to fucking troll her. Like, it's the stupidest moment. He might as well have gone, what did the five fingers say to the face? Slap! And slapped her then. Like, it was like the exact same kind of energy.
We have a message for you from the foot. Shut your butt. Your teeth are showing.
Awful. Also, my favorite phrase in fifth grade.
Okay. Anything else about characters?
I don't think so, no.
All right, let's move on to music, which we actually have something for this, because there is a particularly famous musical number in this film, and that is, well, I call it T-U-R-T-L-E power, but apparently the actual name is just Turtle Power with an exclamation point.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but by Partners in Crime, which is what they play at the end of the film into the credits, a pretty big hit of a song, something that probably stuck with a lot of kids watching this film. There's not a lot to say about it, but I have to mention, because I can't not mention, that the song basically recaps the whole movie incorrectly in a lot of parts, but maybe they are basing this on an earlier version of the script. I don't know. But one thing that has always bothered me for years is that they refer to Raphael as the leader of the group.
Oh.
Like, Raphael, he's the leader of the group, some of the nuclear goop.
Oh.
And that bothered me then, and it bothers me now, to the point that every couple of years I make a big, like, rant about it on social media. But then one day, the people behind the Ninja Turtles, I think currently that's Nickelodeon, they released a new cartoon called Rise of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which is not a cartoon that looks super appealing to me for a bunch of reasons. Perhaps we'll talk about that one day. But in that show, Raphael is the leader of the group. They make a big deal of him being the leader. And I was like, oh no, Partners in Crime got me.
They were playing the long game.
Oh my god! It took almost 30 years, but they But they did it, those sons of bitches. Partners in Crime, by the way, is super short-lived. I think they were probably formed for this song. I'm not 100% certain. But they only existed from like 90 to 91, and then they got back together in 2015. Also, when they performed this song in later years, they changed the lyrics to Raphael is the bad boy of the group.
Oh. Okay.
But, you know, too little, too late. So bitter about it. Okay. Any thoughts about this song? Like, do you have anything to add?
I like it fine. Although, like, I hate to say this because, you know, fucking Vanilla Ice, but technically the second movie with the Go Ninja Go thing is catchier. It's just easier. It's easier for a kid to get that in their head than this one. But this one is
I don't know. I don't know if I completely agree with that, because I think the hook of T-U-R-T-L-E power is still super catchy. And I definitely think that ninja rap is garbage.
Well, I think I'm saying this as a child who was younger than you. Like, it is easier for the smaller child to go ninja, girl, ninja, go, than have to try to, like, spell shit.
Okay. I guess that's fair. Yeah, we'll probably talk about that song. Should we ever do Secret of the Ooze?
Cool.
any other thoughts about the movie before we wrap things up?
No, I don't. I do contemplate how fucking hot those costumes must have been. Like,
oh, super hot.
Like, shout out to doing that. Like, it must have been such a bummer being in those suits. And I do, considering that it's like the early 90s and stuff, and it was relatively low budget, I bet they were not being cared for the way they should have been throughout filming. And I just feel for those guys.
So this doesn't make it better, but interesting trivia about the suits. There were two sets of suits. There was the main suits that were probably extraordinarily hard to have on. And then there was the stunt suits, which did not have any of the animatronic stuff in. And that's like where you see them in action, in like action scenes, and how they're, you know, so mobile, because they don't have all that crap on their backs and on their face.
Because those are like super heavy, right? Like,
they would be.
Yeah.
Also, there's that scene near the end of the movie, like the final battle, where like two of the turtles, I forget which ones, like do like kind of a cartwheel attack where they're like spinning around together, like in like a forward flip, and they're knocking people over. Mm. I remember thinking like, wow, it looks so much better than what Popeye did in the Popeye movie. All right, Ariel, so let's go ahead and close this out. So what would you give Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles the movie? A thumbs up, a thumbs down, or a thumb somewhere in the middle?
I'm gonna give it a middle. Yeah. Okay. I think I don't have like the things that I find like wrong with it. Like, it's not I'm not as upset with it as I have been like with other movies, and I feel like movies that we've done recently I've done so many rants on. So it's like, it's not bad as that. It is not a thumbs up for me, though, for sure.
Well, I gotta tell you, it is a thumbs up for me. I really enjoy this film. I think that it's still a fun movie to watch. I think that is the potentially best adaptation of the original comic that the Turtles have ever done. I think it's more accurate than what live-action stuff we've gotten lately.
And I should probably say this is also coming from a person who has not watched like basically any of the other stuff besides like the cartoon that used to be on years and years and years ago. But like all the like newer iterations, like I have seen like none of them. So this is coming from a skewed angle, probably.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think it's. I had a good time with it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think that there's a lot of problems with it. I think, although I think in general the movie has aged well in terms of tone and visuals and effects.
Still a fun time.
Yeah, there are things that have not aged well and kind of make it a product of its time. If you can get past that, I think that you'll enjoy that film. And whether or not you can get past that is will be, you know, whether I should revisit this. I have seen Secret of the Ooze within the last couple of years, not super recently, but compared to that movie, this movie is The Godfather. It's The Godfather and The Godfather Part 2, and then Secret of the Ooze is The Godfather Part 3. And then Ninja Turtles 3, I believe, is just somebody farting into a microphone.
Just someone farting with a New York accent.
Yeah. Okay, so I think that's going to do it for us this week. So next week, we are doing something. I say next week. Who knows when it's going to be? It could be a long time from now. But hopefully it
next won't time.
Be. Yeah, next time. Hopefully it won't be past mid-May. So next time, we're going to do something a little different. We are going to do a request. It's like someone emailed us.
Ooh.
And asked us to do a specific movie, and we're going to do it. And it is a movie that Ariel and I did watch a lot when we were growing up. It was more of a movie that she enjoyed, I will admit.
Yeah.
But it is the Drew Barrymore vehicle of Ever After. Not a modern interpretation, like it's like set in modern time, but like modern sensibility reinterpretation of the Cinderella story.
Yeah, yeah. And it's been a while since we've had some Angelica Houston action, so like that's exciting.
Yeah, so we're going to check that out. I'm very interested to see how that goes. I'm mainly interested to see my opinion of it, because it was one of those movies that was like, ugh, a girl movie. I don't know if go somewhere else. But I'm a lot less sexist now, so I'm curious to see how I feel about it. I just remember the trailer where you have Drew Barrymore coming into a room. She's like, just breathe.
Yeah, I was about to say, just breathe. I also was like super obsessed with the costumes in this movie. Did it have an influence of why I am now do a lot of Shakespeare acting? I don't know. Half the time when I do Shakespeare, I'm a guy anyway, but I do love some old-timey gowns. Everything is just so pretty.
I'm eager to hear Drew Barrymore's accent in this, because she's not an actor who is known for doing accents.
Yeah,
I believe she has an English accent in this.
I do remember that she does, and I don't remember that she does it again after this movie, so I guess we'll find out how it goes.
Yep, that's going to be fun. This person who we'll talk about in more detail next week, they made a request for us to do an episode. You can also make a request. I can't guarantee that we'll do it. It might kind of depend on the availability and how much we actually know about the film. Like, I'm not sure if you just say, like, do this random film from the 1960s because I liked it. Not 100% certain if we can just do it. But you can find out by emailing us at adultsiblingsversus@gmail.com. And let us know what you'd like to hear. Or let us know what you thought about Ninja Turtles or anything else that we're talking about. Or tell us that what a great job we're doing and that we need to have all the money in the world. And you're very happy to listen to us. Just affirmative things that make us feel good about our lives.
Yeah, give us a positive affirmations. We would like that.
Our theme song is Sell It by Zombie Apocalypse Now from the EP Forbidden Tales of Science. You can find that and more at antizombierock.bandcamp.com. So, Ariel, before we leave, quick question for you. What other weird things do you think was in that missing 12 pages?
There's a moment where, like, Raphael is, like, leaving the movie theater. It starts to rain, and then it becomes this, like, a little bit of a Gene Kelly number. It's beautiful. And it's so sad that they didn't have the budget to actually make that happen.
Oh, man. Do you think that's, like, how he and Casey Jones meet? They meet in that song and dance number?
If only, you know? And then they make their way over to the antique shop. But it's just...
That would have been the thing that makes us see the good side of Casey Jones.
Yeah. Yeah, he needed more dancing.
All right, well, we're going to go ahead and get Jeffrey Katzenberg on the line to see if we can get him to give those guys that $1 million after all. But until next time, as always, please do not put a dirty sock in your younger sibling's mouth.
Radical, radical, radical.
T-U-R-T-L-E power. T-U-R-T-L-E power. T-U-R-T-L-E power. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles power. If you stand for what you believe in, and you fight for what's right, that's turtle power.
That affected me as a child. It stuck with me.